B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. I've gotten unexpected vindication of a claim that I've been making for years, if not decades. This relates to the super-secret FISA court, the Star Chamber, that should be shut down, but won't. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That's what FISA stands for. And I have been an outspoken opponent for many, many years. And more recently, when the Carter Page brouhaha led to a kind of selective investigation by the Justice Department Inspector General, I argued that the problems extended far beyond the flaws in the repeated renewal requests that were made to the FISA court to continue the surveillance of Carter Page. He was a volunteer for the Trump campaign, one of those expendable people. And I never took him very seriously as a figure or even a conduit for the so-called Russiagate scandal. But when that report was issued, and Trump was jumping up and down saying, see, I'm a victim of the deep state. I said, well, maybe, but there is a much bigger problem here. And I cited that one of the hardliners who ran the FISA court for several years, Judge Retchie Walton of the, he's either on the district bench or the appeals court now in Washington, D.C. He's an African-American. He is a stalwart defender of the muscular intelligence operations, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So curiously today, the accounts in the New York Times and the Washington Post use almost identical headlines. The Times: problems in FBI wiretap applications go beyond Trump aid surveillance, comma, review finds. The Post: problems with FBI surveillance extended far beyond probe of Trump campaign, comma, Justice Department Inspector General says. And get this. Michael Horowitz and his office, the Inspector General, they chose 29 applications submitted by the FBI to the court, we're told, at random. It's a random sample. We don't know the universe of how many FBI filings have been made over any period of time. And we're not given a range of dates on this. But of the 29 random sample applications that were reviewed by the IG, they found problems with all 29. 25 of those, they found an average of 20 problems each. One application had 65 issues, and four others could not be scrutinized at all because the FBI couldn't locate what's called the Woods file. That's where it's supposed to catalog the supporting documentation for each factual claim made in a FISA application. And in the dry language of the Inspector General, we do not have confidence that the FBI has executed its Woods procedures in compliance with FBI policy, or that the process is working as it was intended to help achieve the scrupulously accurate standard for FISA applications. Now, cutting through the bureaucraties, the FBI has played fast and loose. They have filed one defective application after another. It's what led Judge Walton to scream from the bench, saying, I don't have any independent way of confirming this. But time and time again in the quarterly reports, we discover that there were errors and false statements that were submitted, mostly by the FBI, but these transgressions, I believe, apply to the CIA, which occasionally uses that, and more often the NSA. National Security Agency, the spooks who are listening to your phone calls. And the Post goes a little deeper. The Times has just a fairly short report by Charlie Savage, who's a credible reporter. And over at the Post, again, they use weasel words. The findings suggest, however, that the Bureau may be suffering from broad institutional weaknesses more than political bias, as problems were found in an array of cases managed by FBI field offices around the country. Now, let me restate that. This shows widespread abuse that suggests that the secret policy of the FBI was do whatever it takes to get a warrant to surveil on Americans or people who are U.S. persons who may be communicating with someone outside of the United States. And the Post trots out Stephen Vladek, a law professor at UT Austin. He said it shows the entire process is prone to abuse. Quote, the irony here is that in one sense, this report suggests the Carter Page episode was not a partisan political scandal. The irony is it suggests it was part of a far bigger, more problematic pattern, a nonpartisan, systemic problem. He went on, the report should hopefully put to rest the assertion we hear across different administrations that we can trust the Justice Department to check itself. I want that to sink in a little bit, because that is the reality. Aside from an occasional review by the court or by the inspectors general, the FBI operates with great independence and impunity. And it is similar, not directly connected, to the abusive prosecutions using paid informants that frame up mostly Muslim Americans who may have committed a minor crime, but are led into criminal behavior where the idea, the means, the resources to commit said crime are provided by the paid FBI informant. It's a frame-up. And Trevor Aronson has documented the repeated pattern. Sometime with these schlub defendants who end up getting a 25-year sentence, people with mental handicaps. There was one outsized case, I think it came from Arizona, where the FBI groomed a young man who they made contact with at about age 16. They kept slipping him burner phones despite the mother's repeated demand that they stop. And when the kid turned 18, they set him up for a crime, busted him, and he'll be in prison for a long, long time. I don't recall the specifics of what his sentence was. And quoting from the IG report, the comparison of FISA applications to corresponding Woods files identified apparent errors or inadequately supported facts in all of the 25 applications we reviewed. These are not accidents. These are not just a case of sloppy paperwork, as was alleged in the Carter Page investigation. And the FBI has a silly response. They've been intensely focused on implementing these remedial measures with the goal of ensuring that our FISA authorities are exercised with objectivity and integrity. Well, come on. There ain't no integrity at the FBI. And I'm biased. I've explained that my contact with COINTELPRO, because when I was a young talk show host in Chicago, I interviewed the attorneys who represented the family of Fred Hampton, who was set up by the FBI for outright cold-blooded murder conducted by the Chicago police, 1969. And ever since, I have been a critic of this agency, and it runs a massive propaganda self-promotion campaign that includes TV shows and placing people in movies. So here we have momentary vindication. And let's give it till the end of this year. Congress is a little busy these days, right? Will there be any move in the House of Representatives, currently controlled by Democrats, to reform or disband the FISA court? And I can tell you right now, the answer is no. Somebody like the independent former Republican from Michigan, Justin Amash, or the now widely despised Tom Massey of Northern Kentucky, they care about the Fourth Amendment more than almost any Democrat that I have been aware of. Maybe they will pursue some reform. And the Senate? Hopeless. I wanted to catch up because on Friday, Trump conducted his signing ceremony for the $2-plus billion bailout package. I'm looking at the picture of all these white guys, Mnuchin, McConnell, McCarthy, Pence, and some goon I can't identify. But they're all white guys flanking the president. And, of course, they're violating the social distancing policies to provide the wallpaper for the photo ops that Trump loves so much. And while he was conducting that photo op and signing the bill, in part to rescue the economy from market crashes that he caused through his lies and dissembling, he also conducted what is called the signing statement. He approved them and signed off on them. And the signing statement said that he would not allow an inspector general to report to Congress on the doling out of at least $500 billion in the stimulus package, because it would interfere with executive authority. He said that handing out the slush fund to his cronies requires presidential supervision. And I want to thank Bob Agelko. He is the estimable legal affairs writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. And what I learned from his article is that this signing statement is the 769th, yes, 769 signing statements have been imposed by Trump since he took office. And Agelko quotes Christopher Kelly, assistant professor of political science, Miami University in Ohio, who has studied presidential power. He also reviewed all of George W. Bush's signing statements. And Trump is number one. Bush used 750 in his first term. And the professor Kelly says Trump does not appear to have any idea of the limits of the president's constitutional power. And we know that now he survived the badly managed impeachment process that originated in the democratically controlled House, that he feels that he's totally above the law and he can do whatever he effing wants. Also, buried in the fine print of the bill, you know, Trump had called for a payroll tax suspension. And many people like me argued that that would simply cut off the revenue stream to Social Security and Medicare, and now enabling them to, you know, declare it insolvent in the future. Well, what they did instead was change the schedule for employers to pay their payroll taxes to the IRS. They are given a break. They don't have to pay the first half of deferred taxes until December 31st of next year. They're getting a holiday. They get to keep that money and float it for a full year for the first half and 2 years for the second half. That is really slimy. And we'll see how it all plays out, you know, in the finances of the so-called entitlement programs of Social Security and Medicare. And since I am eligible for both of those, there is a little more than passing self-interest in that matter. Before we get to our COVID-19 update, I want to tell you how painful it is when I have interactions on Facebook or I hear from people who are in denial about the virus. And as you know, we lost a family member, Brian Shatter, in Detroit over the weekend. I appreciate all the condolences and sympathy that people have extended to my partner Kathy and me. But this divide is really painful to see. And I'll give you a couple of examples. We have a neighbor, a couple who are pretty staunch Republicans, always have been. And let me call them Mr. and Mrs. Trumper. They're both very nice people. Now, we get along great. We know we can't talk politics. In fact, I haven't talked politics with them since Sarah Palin was named as McCain's running mate in 2008. And they flipped out over my criticism. It was very gentle. But yesterday, Mrs. Trumper dropped by and maintaining some adequate distance. She dropped off some flowers, and she had a conversation with my partner, Kathy. And Kathy asked her how she thought, Mrs. Trumper thought, that the president, her president, is managing this crisis. And she said, "It's perfect." And then she repeated it, "Perfect." And Kathy was stunned. And she said, "Really? Where do you get your news?" she asked. And Mrs. Trumper proudly proclaimed, "Fox, 24/7. And so this suggests to me that there is a Fox virus that afflicts these right-wingers, and our neighbors are, you know, adhering to the shelter in place for the most part. I'm not going to turn them in for anything because I'm not sheltered at my house right now. But the idea that by only viewing Fox News, which is never critical of their president, they actually believe that his response is perfect. Now, this is not limited to the right. I got into a big argumentative exchange last night on Facebook with a man I've known since the late 1990s. He's based in Sacramento. He's a lobbyist, not for evil stuff, as far as I know. And he worked for a very progressive legislator. And I'll limit the details just to avoid any embarrassment or blowback. But he has been repeatedly sniping at Governor Gavin Newsom. First, for declaring the shelter in place. And last night, he was complaining because Newsom didn't impose it soon enough. And I've tried to chide him as a backseat driver and say, "Come on." And he has this Facebook persona, which I describe as imperious. And a mutual Facebook friend, who I only know a little, but he is a very big-hearted progressive who works in the arena of media and criminal justice reform. And this man had just lost his brother-in-law on Sunday to COVID. And the lobbyist guy kind of blew past that and was just running these numbers and saying, you know, that Newsom has overreacted, and then he didn't impose the restrictions soon enough. And I don't know where these people get off. Because my view is that the governor, with a few minor issues that I have, has managed this crisis, not perfectly. I don't think anybody's perfect, but in a way that I find very impressive. And he shows strong leadership and a willing to take risks. And maybe it's just the cabin fever of people cooped up. And maybe the lobbyist had a bill of one of his clients vetoed by the governor. I don't know. But it's just painful to see this at such a critical time. Now to our COVID-19 news summary for today, prepared by Linda Lewis. And I'm grateful to Linda for all of the work she does to compile this. Caseload in the United States, 164,000. 2,860 deaths on the books at the CDC. The number is likely higher. Worldwide, 635,000 confirmed cases and just under 30,000 deaths across the globe. Linda cites a report from the New York Times. Some of Europe's largest, best-funded hospitals have issued an urgent warning, saying they're rapidly running out of essential drugs and that more coordination from countries across the continent is desperately needed. The British government offered its first count of deaths among people who were not hospitalized, an indication that the true death toll might be at least 20% higher than previously reported. There are many people who are still trapped on cruise ships, which are being denied access to ports. The president of the Holland America Line called for a port to show compassion and grace by allowing passengers, I almost said prisoners, but they are, on the Zaandam cruise liner and its sister ship, the Rotterdam, to come ashore. On the Zaandam, 4 people have died, 8 tested positive for COVID, and about 200 people are ill with flu-like symptoms. Many of the passengers, including hundreds of British, American, and Australians, are elderly. Now, both ships are traveling toward Florida, but on Monday, Trump's lackey, Governor Ron DeSantis, said passengers cannot be dumped in his state, and he cast further doubt about whether ships would be allowed to dock, dismissing those on board as mostly foreigners. That's my mispronunciation. I don't know if he says it that way. Several Latin American countries have already closed their ports to the Zaandam, and the U.S. is no better. There are at least 8 cruise ships still at sea, and the industry has told us that they stopped launching new cruises in mid-March. But Linda notes that in early March, Carnival was offering passengers a $200 onboard credit to not cancel their cruise. And according to leaked emails obtained by the Miami New Times, Norwegian managers were pressuring salespeople to lie about the dangers of coronavirus, including telling customers they could not contract the illness because of the tropical climate where they planned to sail. And that's false. And in our northern neighbor, Canada's parliament has approved a $52 billion financial package that promises workers a Canadian $2,000 a month benefit for up to 4 months, whether or not they are eligible for employment insurance. It also extends additional help to low and modest income individuals and families, a temporary wage subsidy to some small employers for 3 months, additional assistance to families with children. But that's socialism, you know, so it can never happen here. And Mitch McConnell is throwing cold water on Nancy Pelosi's ideas to move ahead with a fourth package, which would include major infrastructure spending to try to restore the economy and bring some new jobs. And get this. Trump announced today that he encouraged Congress to pass a $2 trillion infrastructure bill because it's free money. He hammered the Fed to reduce the interest rate to almost zero, the prime rate. And so now he's saying that, you know, he can run up the deficit just as far as he wants, and it don't matter. So this paints Mitch McConnell as the odd man out, And we'll see what happens next or how soon some new package is introduced. And speaking of those cruise ships, there is an American aircraft carrier that is now kind of isolated on the island of Guam in the Pacific. They got booted out of Vietnam because of the risk of coronavirus. And willing to stand up and maybe get fired, the captain of the USS Teddy Roosevelt went public about the dire situation on the warship. More than 4,000 crew members there, and they have identified cases, I believe four so far, of people who have tested positive. And the captain is Brett Crozier. "We are not at war," Captain Crozier wrote. "Sailors do not need to die. If we do not act now, we are failing to properly take care of our most trusted asset, our sailors." Mixed messages have emerged across the armed services. Last week, the Army ordered a halt to most training, exercises and non-essential activities that require troops to be in close contact. But that was abruptly reversed a couple of days later by Trump's defense secretary and the former Raytheon lobbyist, or maybe he was an executive there, whose name is Esper, Mark Esper. So Crozier is asking for approval to offload his entire crew, quarantine, test them while they're on soil, on an island, and then have the ship fully sanitized. But 4,000 people is a big population. And he argues that a warship, here it is, none of the berthing aboard a warship is appropriate for quarantine or isolation. So this is a growing problem, and the top-down denial that silences the people who are closest to the problems extends beyond governors and other opponents of our narcissistic president. Here in California, Governor Newsom has announced the launch of a health care corps looking for 30 or 40,000 volunteers coming from medical schools, the pool of retired doctors and nurses. He's asked the unions to suspend some of the staffing to patient and supervisor to worker ratios. The estimate is, with currently 75,000 hospital beds and an estimate of an additional need for 50,000 hospital beds, that they are going to need qualified personnel to manage the load. And here in California, going back to Linda's report, we have a total of 7,350 confirmed cases, a jump from 6,032 yesterday, and our death count is now at 146. In Maryland, after Trump has said that he hasn't heard about testing for weeks, the Republican governor, Larry Hogan, went on CNN, said that the lack of testing kits has left Maryland sort of guessing about where the outbreaks are and about what the infection rate and hospitalization rates are. Hogan was careful not to blame the federal government or his Trumpness, and he co-authored with the demonized governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, an article, an op-ed in the Washington Post. And they agree, despite being of different parties, there simply aren't enough of these test kits. In Washington, D.C., they're toughening up on the largely minority population there and threatening 90 days in jail. Oh, that'll fix it. And a $5,000 fine if they leave their homes, except for the approved outings for groceries and essential work. I don't support that kind of heavy-handed enforcement. I certainly do want people to cooperate. And there's only one case I've heard of here in California where a surfer dude, I think it was in Orange County, ignored repeated requests for him to stay off the beach and not go surfing. He defied them, and they wrote him a ticket for a potential $1,000 fine. The coronavirus studies that apparently convinced Trump to prolong disruptive social distancing in the United States paint a grim picture, expecting a death rate of about 100,000 Americans over the next month or two, or perhaps through the summer. And Deborah Brix, the fashionista who goes out and defends Trump at the podium, she does have a background in epidemiology. But she admitted, we reviewed 12 different models, and then we went back to the drawing board over the last week or two and made our own model, and we ended up at the same numbers. The old saw is that what happens in Las Vegas stays in Vegas, but this one leaked out. The casinos are deserted, this is the voice of the New York Times, and thousands of hotel rooms are empty. But when Vegas, gripped by the coronavirus, needed space for a temporary homeless shelter, officials chose a location that does not have walls or even a roof. They've put 500 people in an outdoor parking lot. They lay down some carpet, then they striped the carpets to create, you know, these squares that if you sit in the center, you'll be 6 feet away from the homeless person in the next little cube. The city of Las Vegas and Clark County opened the shelter Saturday, the upper floor of a convention center parking lot, after the temporary closure of a homeless shelter run by Catholic Charities after one person there tested positive. They've got medical students wearing protective gear, but the homeless people don't get any. There's an estimated 6,500 homeless people in the Las Vegas area. 70%, they say, of the city's homeless population sleeps outside. Now, they have pretty good weather. It gets steaming hot in the summer. But the winters are generally mild, and as you know, it doesn't rain very often in Las Vegas. But really, that's just the deplorable scene that we saw at the border without the cages. I want to thank our friend Karen Bradley. She is a whiz with a sewing machine. And she dropped off at our house without any contact a plastic bag, a Ziploc, with two face masks that she made with her sewing machine yesterday. And they both use fabric that has pictures of Elvis. So I think I'm going to start wearing it when I go out in public. And I'll be the guy with the bald head and the Elvis face mask. And Dr. Anthony Fauci has said they are considering a review, that they think it can't hurt for most Americans to wear a face mask when they're out in public. But the concern is that if he makes that recommendation, that like toilet paper, there'll be a run on consumers picking up face masks at the expense of our medical professionals who are on the front lines. Now, this is simply enraging. In Texas, Dr. Henry Nikositz finished an emergency intubation of a man in his 70s. The doctor is an anesthesiologist. So then he stepped out of the operating room, hopped in an elevator, but he kept his face mask on because he saw people wandering down the hall toward him. He was reflexively trying to protect himself and them. But in the days that followed, Dr. Nikositz said, he was told that his job was at risk because policy at the hospital where he works, the University Medical Center in El Paso, prohibited the use of protective masks in the hallways. Now, the 60-year-old doctor has asthma and hypertension, and he refused to back down. So they took him off the schedule, effectively suspending him from work without pay. And the reason is they thought it would convey a negative message to patients. Now, this is such bullshit, bureaucratic bullshit, but it's not limited to El Paso. In Seattle, one of the early hot zones of the virus, Dr. Oliver Small, Cherry Hills campus of Swedish Medical Center, was threatened with indefinite suspension for wearing a surgical mask when not directly involved in patient care. His wife posted on Facebook that he got called into meetings with administration because they don't want to panic employees into thinking they need to wear masks for protection. The hospital made him attend a meeting where they told him he could take off the mask or stop coming to work. Wow. I mean, I don't know the exact situation at that hospital in Seattle, but how can they afford to impose such trivial restrictions and suspend a doctor during a time of crisis? Also happened at the Cleveland Clinic. I don't have the name of the doctor who was threatened, but it's shocking to see this happen in multiple locations. Last week, I may have offended some of our listeners who are spiritual, religious, with my criticism of Trump's God Squad, including the White House Bible study leader who's denying that there's any real threat from the coronavirus. And now let's talk about Pastor Rodney Howard Brown, who runs a megachurch in Tampa and is a big member of Trump's God Squad. Officials in the county said they had repeatedly reached out to Pastor Howard Brown and the staff at the River at Tampa Bay Church, asking them not to hold in-person services for the duration. But Sunday, he held two packed worship services. And so the sheriff, citing his reckless disregard for human life and putting hundreds of people in his congregation at risk, thousands in the community, the sheriff, Chad Cronister, warned him and then had him arrested. But the Reverend Howard Brown is unbowed because he is fighting against forces that want to shut down Christianity in his twisted view. He said at one of the services, not only the right of free speech, but the right to peaceful assembly and practice what we believe is threatened. Suddenly we're demonized because we believe God heals. He warned about a coming physical war, that the regulations being put in place by local, state, and federal officials were being put in place to shut down the church. This whole thing, he said, is planned that way to shut down the gospel, shut down Christianity. And he seemed to believe that by praying, get this, I believe this will be a time of supernatural sustenance. You look at your toilet paper and you think you're going to run out of toilet paper, but you have another roll where that other one was and you don't even know where how that even took place. Look, I was raised a Catholic. I know the story about Jesus and the loaves and fishes, but he never presided over a multiplication of toilet paper. And that's not all. The state officials who have used the pretext of the pandemic and the measures that have been taken in most states, used it as a pretext to block abortions for the foreseeable future. That was part of a broader order to limit what were called non-essential medical procedures. And to have a bunch of white guys, and it's all white guys, who made these orders, decree that abortions are non-essential is such a presumptuous thought and judgment. And fortunately, federal judges have issued orders requiring Texas, Ohio, and Alabama to allow abortion clinics to stay open and keep providing services. The order came down on Monday after a wave of lawsuits. In Texas, Judge Lee Yackel, or Yackel maybe, said that the order in Texas would cause irreparable harm to abortion clinics and their patients. The harm outweighs Texas's reason for the order. Regarding a woman's right to a pre-fetal viability abortion, the Supreme Court has spoken clearly. There can be no outright ban on such a procedure. This court will not speculate on whether the Supreme Court included a silent except in a national emergency clause in its previous writings on the issue. One of the other insults is that in at least one of the states, it was Texas, they said that the clinics could not even issue pharmaceutical abortion pills that could be provided outside of the clinic via telemedicine and picked up at a pharmacy. And this merger of religiosity and political opportunism, I find deeply offensive. Oh, and here's another offensive move. I told you yesterday about Judge Dolly G. in Los Angeles, who presides over the long-running case and federal orders related to the detention of minors in our immigration lockups. She ordered them all released and gave a tight timeline for responses about action taken to do that. Well, I don't know if this is a reaction to that directly, but in a major departure from previous practice mandated by federal law, the Trump administration has begun quickly deporting immigrant children apprehended alone at the southern border. They say they're following public health orders designed to prevent the spread of coronavirus. But opponents say they're using the health orders to skirt federal laws that govern the processing of unaccompanied minors. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Let's see who's on the PayPal list today. Joe Clarici, Mark Shapiro, Perry DeLorenzo, and Carl Howard, our buddy in Columbus, Ohio. I'm grateful to each of you for your support, and I use you to model behavior for others who are not current subscribers to get on board. All you have to do is drop by peterbcollins.com or go to peterbcollins.com/signup. And the options are right there, $5, $10, $20 a month. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount. And there's a 24-hour pass. If you want to hear our Scott Ritter interview from yesterday and you don't have a subscription, just pony up a buck and you're good to go. In a recap of Trump's recent attacks from the podium, where he's generating huge ratings, almost like The Apprentice, New York Times reporter Annie Carney sums it up, that his attacks from that podium and on Twitter are often aimed at women. Like last week when General Motors put together its partnership with a very small ventilator company and said that they would reopen a plant in Indiana to manufacture the much-needed ventilators. Trump complained, oh, they were charging too much money. It was $1.5 billion. They weren't going to produce enough machines, ignoring the realities of retooling an auto assembly line to make a completely different product, and one that I believe requires much more sterile conditions. So Trump has singled out the female chief executive at General Motors, Mary Barra, tweeting, as usual with this General Motors, things just never seem to work out. This GM apparently referring to one led by the first female chief executive of an American auto company. And then there's her neighbor, probably in Bloomfield Hills, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor and a Democrat in Michigan. We've had a big problem with the young woman governor, he said to Sean Hannity last week. You know who I'm talking about, from Michigan. And he dismissed Whitmer, who has been pressing the federal government for more medical equipment, noting she's a new governor and had not been pleasant. And his derisive nickname for her is Gretchen Half Whitmer. She doesn't have a clue. I don't really know what half means. So then, of course, he had told Pence in the Friday news show not to call the woman in Michigan. I say, if they don't treat you right, don't call. So his peevishness and the lack of these people willing to genuflect and kiss his ass means that people in Michigan can just die. And as we've noted, that's really pretty short-sighted of a guy who really needs Michigan if he hopes to win this November. You know the case of Yamiche Alcindor of the PBS NewsHour, who's been a frequent target of Trump's attacks. And good thinking by Michelle Goldberg, a New York Times opinion writer who I often disagree with. But she makes a comparison to Trump's effort to shake down Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. I'd like you to do us a favor, though, with the way he is presiding over the response and the doling out of vitally needed equipment. She says, look, Trump is not demanding the governors investigate Joe Biden, but he's strongly suggesting that if governors speak candidly about his monumental incompetence, he'll penalize them and their states. Yeah, collective punishment. Using his control once again of vital aid to extort assistance with his reelection. And Adam Schiff, who I have very mixed feelings about, but he's right here. There are a lot of parallels between the president's behavior now and during the whole Ukraine scandal. Certainly the most apparent is his demand that the governors basically pay fealty to him, praise him, or they'll suffer consequences. And you know by now that Chris Cuomo, who is an evening anchor on CNN and the little brother of the governor of New York, has been diagnosed with the virus. And it's reported, I didn't see it last night, that he anchored his show from quarantine in the basement of his home. And the governor lamented the current bidding wars over ventilators, getting off a good line. He said having 50 states and the Federal Emergency Management Agency simultaneously tried to obtain more ventilators, he said, was like being on eBay. I credit the New York Times for walking and chewing gum at the very same moment. They open a critical editorial of Governor Cuomo by praising him for his disciplined and deft management of the crisis, and immediately shift to this. State spending for the coming fiscal year, expected to be about $175 billion, must by law be approved by tonight, midnight, March 31st. This year's budget season comes as the virus has hobbled the economy, devastated state revenues. They've already spent over $1 billion to fight the pandemic, and they project a revenue shortfall of at least $15 billion. And the governor and his allies have tried to link the budget to reform of bail reform. They want to return to cash bail on terms that give judges even more discretion than they had before the reforms were passed last year. And this is one of my misgivings about Andrew Cuomo. And I see people on Facebook saying, hey, let's have a backroom deal at the DNC and install Andrew Cuomo as the Democratic nominee. Well, I take umbrage to that because Bernie Sanders supporters have worked hard, and Bernie, we'll get to him in a moment. He is in second place. He's the only other candidate in the Democratic primary, which is not completely over. And the premature efforts to elbow him out of the way, I think, are a gross abuse of the democratic process. And because I have serious concerns about Joe Biden's viability and his survival from the sexual assault accusations that are being suppressed in the corporate media, I think that it's unwise to start talking about these dream scenarios. And a woman I love, I don't know her that well, love her, but I like her a lot, was on Facebook last night saying, hey, let's just do an Etch-a-Sketch. And let's set up new primaries or some kind of process where state delegates pick a candidate from a pool of people that excluded Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, to be fair. I don't support that. Anyway, back to this editorial. There will also be a push to revise the state's Medicaid program. Though there are plenty of improvements to be made and cost savings to be found, it is vital that the public hospitals which serve the poorest patients not be harmed, especially as they fight a pandemic. So there are many facets to Andrew Cuomo, and his management of this crisis is the best one. Oh, and this is funny. Mitch McConnell, in an interview with the hostile radio host Hugh Hewitt, that's sarcasm, Hewitt is just this right-wing apologist, Mitch blamed the Democratic-led impeachment effort for distracting the administration from the early stages of the coronavirus crisis. Now, this goes back to January, when Trump spent his every waking hour stonewalling the House impeachment effort and the truncated trial in the Senate where Mitch did the bidding of the president and blocked any effort to bring in the full picture through evidence and testimony. It came up while we were, you know, tied down in the impeachment trial, McConnell told Hewitt, and I think it diverted the attention of the government because everything every day was all about impeachment. And the Washington Post politely notes that despite that distraction of impeachment, Trump found time in January and February to hold a whole bunch of his Keep America Great mob rallies in various parts of the country. Now to the Sanders story. I didn't know that Seth Meyers was continuing to produce his late-night show, but Bernie Sanders was a guest early this morning. That would have been last night. And he says, I've got a narrow path remaining for my candidacy. He says, campaigns are an important way to maintain the fight and raise public consciousness on my issues. Medicare for all, raising the minimum wage, combating climate change, expanding paid family and medical leave. So, Bernie said, I think that is one of the arguments for going forward. I want to note that I've been calling, and I'm not alone, for a worldwide ceasefire during this pandemic and maybe even beyond. And Consortium News today, in an unsigned article, notes that Italy on Monday became the 53rd nation to join a call by the UN Secretary General for a ceasefire in all of the world's wars. But the U.S. continues to wage wars on various fronts with different means. Headline in the British Guardian, U.S. ignores calls to suspend Venezuela and Iran sanctions amid coronavirus pandemic. And I think that's a very reasonable thing to do. But Trump and Pompeo and the other goons, they see this as an opportunity. They're weaponizing the pandemic. And Bill Barr said the timing of his phony lawsuit or his indictment of Nicolas Maduro and 14 top Venezuelan and current and former officials. It's good timing, actually. The people in Venezuela are suffering, and they need an effective government that responds to the people, one selected by the United States, of course. And then we get Elliot Abrams, the man with blood on his hands from a number of incidents in Central America during the Reagan administration. He's now the U.S. Special Representative for Venezuela, and he's now floated a plan for a transitional government that would not include Nicolas Maduro or Juan Guaido, the man who has no legal claim to being president but is nevertheless recognized by the United States and 50 toady nations. Under the democratic transition framework outlined by Elliot Abrams, all political prisoners would be released, all foreign, that's Cuban, forces would leave, a five-member council of state would be selected, two members chosen by Maduro, two by the Guaido team, and those four would get to pick the fifth. Now, isn't that brilliant? It is regime change it's not very stealthy, but that's what they're attempting. And get this. One of the hardliner Democrats, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, New York's Elliot Engel, he's calling bullshit on this, and this is a surprise. Essentially, Maduro regime officials are being told on one hand that nothing they do will stop the U.S. from pressing charges against them, while on the other hand, they are being asked to agree to a transition government for unrelated sanctions relief. The people of Venezuela cannot afford such a ham-handed approach. It's time to get serious about our Venezuela policy. Over at the Gray Zone Project, an excellent column by Yasha Levine, a man I've gotten to know a little bit and respect his journalism. And he begins by citing what he calls crazy, viral, xenophobic theorizing that ties the disruption caused by corona closures to Russia, to Putin, in some cases to China. And at the center of his article is quotations from a man named Rob Wallace, an academic who he says has been doing amazing pioneering work on an issue. And that issue is that the real driver of Corona isn't China. It's our oligarchic, hyper-industrial mode of food production. This monopolized, vertically integrated system was perfected here in America and then exported to every corner of the world. It paves over everything, prioritizes concentration of wealth and maximum profitability for a tiny elite, while offloading the death and destruction to everyone else. It's created perfect conditions for producing deadly pathogens. It draws out deadly diseases from deep in the forests and jungles by destroying habitats. It builds vertically integrated industrial meat farms filled with cloned animals that breed the most virulent pathogens, and then hooks both of these disease factories to a global supply chain that spreads the stuff around the world and to all of us. Levine continues, "Everyone is focused on trying to contain Corona. Naturally, this is the right thing to do. But there is a deeper problem here. This is not a singular event. Diseases like this, and possibly worse, will keep popping up with greater and greater frequency unless we radically change our hyper-industrialization food production to something that respects the limits of our natural world." There's more. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast, and I hope you will brief yourself on it. I'm also linking to a report in yesterday's Guardian that is based on court documents from a proceeding, a lawsuit, that has brought a judgment against Monsanto for $265 million in a suit brought by a Missouri farmer. The other defendant in the case is the German chemical giant, BASF. And fundamentally, the evidence in discovery shows that Monsanto knew and BASF knew that the connections that they made, this seed to pesticide, Roundup Ready seeds, where you can spray Roundup on them and it kills weeds but it doesn't kill the crop. Well, they knew a long time ago that this is a recipe for disaster. In private meetings dating back to 2009, records show agricultural experts warn that the plan to develop a dicamba-tolerant system would have catastrophic consequences. The experts told Monsanto that farmers were likely to spray old volatile versions of dicamba on the new dicamba-tolerant crops, and even new versions were still likely to be volatile enough to move away from the special cotton and soybean fields onto crops growing on other farms. So this is a very damning report. And I'm running a little long here today, so I won't quote further from it. But I highly recommend that you take a look when you have the time. And finally today, on a lighter note, Brad Schreiber is an author who I interviewed back in January on the publication of his new book, which is called Music is Power. And I'm pleased to see that a guy I admire, Kevin Gostola, over at Shadowproof, has just launched a series of interviews with Brad Schreiber, going into some depth on the history that produced the protest songs, going all the way back to the 1920s and 30s. I'm glad to see it, and I'll follow the series. I hope you'll check it out, too. And I'm going to link to my interview with Brad Schreiber. It's in the show file for today's podcast. Thanks for listening all the way to the end of my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.